So while everybody gets ready, I'll start recapping what the computation about Hamilton-Jacobi that we did yesterday. So on 2 days ago. So the idea is to revisit the action principle, which say that given some boundary conditions, was finding for us one given trajectory, if you want, labeled by these boundary conditions, T0, Q0, T1, Q1, such that delta S at gamma bar equals 0 at fixed boundary conditions. So what does this mean? This means that we have fixed them. The condition in T and Q. And of all possible histories between these two points, we are picking the one that minimizes the action. So this now is completely fixed by the boundary conditions. We're ignoring the problem whether this solution exists or is unique. We're assuming that's the case and moving on. Now, what we do is, okay, we've used the action to compute these to find this physical history, and now we reinsert it into the action and evaluate the action on this history. So this is step one. Step two, reinsert gamma T0, Q0, T1, Q1 into S to define Hamilton's principal function which I'm calling curly S. And this function now, since this solution is fully determined by the boundary condition, will just be a function of the boundary conditions. So T0, Q0, T1, Q1. And this is, by definition, the evaluation of the action on the history or maybe equivalently gamma bar T0. Now we have a function that depends on these arrival points, and what we're doing is to consider what happens if we change them. So we are comparing this is Q, oops, T, this is Q. And so what we do is to compare this one, given history, for example, T0, T1, Q1, with one where we are slightly displacing the initial and final point. We can do this in two possible directions. We can move this point over here and find the new on-shell solution. Or we can do it in the opposite direction, moving T1 and asking what this will be. So if we move this by xi, for example, or this by epsilon, well, maybe epsilon, let's say we move this by epsilon xi, I, and this just by epsilon, because this is just a number. This has many possible directions, of course. So we need to keep track of those. So yesterday we did the computation about the red variation. Today we will do it for the yellow one. Yesterday, last time. So we say that what we did last time was to compute the sum of d over d qi 1 curly s. So we move the arrival point by an amount epsilon xi. And this, the small variation is given by that derivative. And this is this was found to be we had the computation and we proved that this was psi I p. So let me write it completely. We found that this was q dot dl over d q dot I evaluated at t1 and on the history of interest. So how? Well, we rephrase this change of history. So we have to compare the evaluation of this quantity of this action on the green history and the red one. This is a small variation. So we computed the variation of the Lagrangian, integrated by parts so that we got the equations of motion in the bulk. They drop because these are all on-shell histories. So these are on-shell. And we get a boundary term. This boundary term will be is easy to evaluate. Here is 0, because we start always at the same point, and then the arrival point will be parameterized by this xi. So this is that boundary term. And we recognize that this quantity, dl over dq dot, is nothing else than the momentum of associated to this history at the arrival time. So we call this quantity p bar 1, right? Or p, if you as you wish, or p bar at t1, just to make it more explicit. Therefore, we discover that this is nothing else at the particular solution gamma bar, it gives me p1. With a similar argument, one can prove that ds over dq0, so the starting boundary condition instead of the final, the computation is exactly the same. What will change is that the initial boundary term will have the opposite sign. So this will give us minus p0. So this is what we did last time. Any questions about this procedure? Today's will be similar but slightly more complicated, because we see that time appears many different places, appears in the choice of the solution, but also in the integration. So let's call these yellows history. This is gamma prime, which is equal to gamma plus epsilon delta gamma. And delta gamma will have the following properties, which is delta gamma at t0. So what is this is just the initial q. but the initial Q does not change. So this has to be zero. Then we have delta gamma at T1 plus epsilon, which is this one, which is also zero. Or if we want, well, we can say, well, is this the most convenient way? This is also zero because we haven't changed where it's arriving. We just changed what time it's arriving. So maybe I should, this is slightly confusing. So let's say this is gamma bar, gamma prime, and gamma prime is, okay, now it's, I think now it's a bit better. And so the delta, we define the minimum, okay? So this is, the new arrival point, the starting point doesn't change, and the arrival point is the same as before, but at a later time. This is what they say. Okay, so from this now, these are our new boundary conditions, and we have to deduce what happens to the history. So now, as before, we don't really care what happens to the history inside because we'll go away because of the equations of motion. We just need to worry about what happens at the boundary. So in particular, we will want to compute delta gamma at T0, which is zero, and delta gamma at T1. So this is what we do now. Variation with respect to time. We have gamma prime equal gamma plus delta gamma with gamma prime at T0. Gamma prime at T1 plus epsilon equal gamma at T1. And this, so let's work out this one a little bit better. So we write these, this is a little similar to what you did in the tutorial, right? So this is the new solution, so this is gamma at T1 plus epsilon, plus epsilon delta gamma bar at T1 plus epsilon. Right? So I'm just inserting the definition. Basically, this is the definition of what I'm calling delta gamma. But this is the old gamma plus epsilon gamma bar dot at T1, right? I'm just developing using plus stuff. And then the other term will give me, if I remove the epsilon, I get epsilon delta gamma bar T1. And whatever else will be higher order in epsilon. So since we know that this one is equal to, so let me call this star. Now I use the star equality and say that this is gamma bar T1. It means that this term must compensate this term. Therefore, delta gamma bar T1 will be minus gamma bar dot T1 plus higher order corrections. So let me write it here to remember
So now we have our...
So what we did was to compute the variation. So what did we, what we just computed is this variation over here. Now, well, let me do it in a color, maybe. At this point.
So we had this history gamma bar. Then we shifted this over here, and we found the history gamma bar prime.
And what this delta gamma bar at T1
is this guy over here.
So, and also the drawing kind of makes sense because here Q was increasing, was going upwards, so the velocity is positive, and the variation here is negative. So we also check the sign of this equality. Okay, now we just have to plug this into the variation of the action. So we say d over dt1 of our curly S is nothing else than the limit for epsilon that goes to 0 of 1 over epsilon of gamma, gamma bar prime. Maybe I should write it more explicitly. So this is the integral between t0 and now. We change our history, so this will be from T1 plus epsilon. We change our boundary condition, sorry, in T. So now the action associated to this history between these two points has to go up to time epsilon. And this is evaluated at gamma bar prime minus T0 to T1 of dt L evaluated on the original history. So we see that there will be two contributions, one that comes from the change on the history itself, and one that comes from the change of the bounds of integration. So the...
Aldo?
Yes.
Is that order of epsilon or order of epsilon squared? It should be epsilon, right?
This one?
Yeah.
It's epsilon.
So why are you... are we discarding that term later, or?
Yeah, yeah, this we are not caring. We're matching the term of order epsilon in the variation, mm-hmm. and then there is extra stuff, and we don't care. Because this will be higher order in here, so it goes away.
Are you saying that 1 over epsilon is gonna kill the order of epsilon term? In the integral.
So the order 0 cancel, because at order 0 nothing happens.
Right.
At order 1, in the parentheses, they will be carrying an epsilon, which is compensated by this one, and this is the term we keep. If there are terms in epsilon square, they become epsilon square over epsilon, which is an epsilon, and in the limit, they go away.
Okay.
So now the first term I compute is the one that comes from this variation, and this is easy, no? It's just the argument evaluated at the original configuration. So this will be T0, or if we want to do it a bit more slowly, just to avoid mistakes, what I can do is to write it as the integral from T1 to T1 plus epsilon of L gamma prime plus the integral from T0 to T1 of L evaluated at gamma prime minus L evaluated at gamma. So maybe this helps a little bit.
So this now is, I'm integrating on an infinitesimal interval. So this is just epsilon times whatever I'm integrating. So the first term here gives a contribution, which is equal to L evaluated at gamma. Does that make sense, or should I do it more slowly?
Yeah. L evaluated at gamma on at T1.
Yeah. Yes. Sorry. Yes. Thank you. Why? Because, well, maybe I'll do it in. Let me do it here. So this is T1 plus epsilon L gamma prime in dt. But this is just a very thin slice around here. So this is equal to epsilon times L evaluated at gamma prime. But this is epsilon of L evaluated at my and at T1, of course. But this is just the old one plus things plus other variations, which at best will come at order epsilon themselves evaluated at T1. So this is term of higher order. So I just keep this, and that's what I'm keeping. Plus. And now I'm doing the usual thing. Here, the bounds of integration don't change, so I just care about the change in the history. So this will be the integral from T0 to T1. And now I get delta L at gamma bar. But delta L, we computed it many times. We know that. So I should actually change this, write it like this. It's a bit more precise, but this is. So this is now the integral of the Euler-Lagrange equation, so the sum over I of dl over dqi minus d over dt dl over dq dot I delta gamma. Well, maybe gamma, these all evaluated at my solution, delta gamma I, plus a boundary term, which will be given by dl over d gamma dot I, delta gamma I, computed at the two extrema. But this is zero because we are working on shell at this point. All these histories are always on shell. So this is this quantity over here. Is zero. Gamma bar is on shell. And so we are left with this term. Now, what is this term? We have computed delta gamma over there. So this gives us L evaluated at gamma. Well, let's write it like this. Delta gamma at T0 is 0, and at T1 is minus gamma dot. So this will be L minus sum over I, dl gamma dot times gamma dot, all evaluated at my solution and at time t1. So here what I'm using is this result over here. values actually. This. We have this start equation. This is what I'm using in this step. So let's make it visible to everybody. So we recognize what this is, right? This is L minus PQ dot, which is the generalized energy at time t1. So this is our, if you want, or is the generalized energy of the configuration gamma bar computed at t1, at the history gamma bar computed at t1. So this is the second result. So this concludes because we have computed d over dt of s. And we find that d, the variation of Hamilton's principal function at time t1, is equal to the energy evaluated at the time t1. Of course, we could do the same with respect to, minus the energy. I got my sign wrong. Minus the energy. We could do the same at time t0, and for always the usual reasons, this will be plus with the opposite sign because it's the opposite boundary. Give you a second to copy before giving the conclusion. Or if you have any questions on the derivation before we say what comes out of this. Maybe. Yes, Luke.
This relative to minus sign basically by a number, or is there a different
factor? No, it's just when you compute the boundary terms, so the computation does not change at all up to here. When we put in the it does change because there we have also, it changes by a sign also in this term because we're changing it here. So this will be minus epsilon times L. It goes the other way. And so in a way, if you want, you can see this as a time reversal. But if you do the computation step by step, you don't have to be smart. It just comes out on its own because if you do the same computation with the variation at t0, for example, here, you will find the same minus sign. That will not change. But it will change here because I'm evaluating at the opposite boundary. So there will be the evaluation at t1 minus the evaluation at t0. So this will give a minus sign. And here you get a minus sign because you're working with the lower bound and not the upper bound. And therefore it goes the other way. Or if you want, here you would have to write it as the integral from t1 to, so here when we split it up, this one, if you do the same thing at the other bound, this would be minus the integral from t0 to t0 plus epsilon, because you want to remove that piece and not add it. Yeah, so that's another way to see. So all the signs will be duly flipped, and that's the result. Now,
we want to put these two equations together. And of course, this is, as we said, minus the sum over I of pi bar at time 1, gamma bar 1, or q. Sorry if I keep flipping. I'm but let's call it gamma bar at 1. Oops. Minus L gamma bar T1, right? So this is nothing else than the Hamiltonian computed at P1, Q1. Q1, P1, gamma bar 1, P bar 1, T1. Minus, I keep forgetting the minus. So why am I rewriting it like this? Because we have access to P1 from the previous equation. That's what I'm interested in. So, to conclude, putting the two results together, we find that ds over dt1 is equal to, well, I want to write it on the same side, so I bring it to the left-hand side, is h evaluated at q1, which is, remember, this is the argument of s itself. So s was, so this gamma 1 is just q1, the boundary condition. Is the argument of S. And the other and the MP, on the other hand, is not an argument of S, but can be computed from S, from the principal function in this form. So what I'm doing here is that this is ds over dq1 t1. And this is called the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. So this equation turns out to be equivalent to the Lagrangians, Euler-Lagrange equations of motion and the Hamiltonian equations of motion. It contains all the information about the dynamics, but it does so quite beautifully just in terms of these boundary conditions. So for example, and this is a big jump, but if you're doing holography, we want to encode everything happening on the inside based on what we know about the boundary. So this formulation of mechanics, in fact, it becomes relevant when studying holography, for example. So here, we don't have to know anything about any of that. Is just an observation that we're encoding the mechanics in the boundary conditions. This is the first remark. It's a hard equation to solve, although for certain systems, it can be quite useful using some tricks. We will not do that, but one can try to solve these using separations of variables and so on. And if the system is integrable, there are lots of nice results that one can deduce from this equation. But we just take it. I just wanted to show you this equation. We will not really use it. Because first, it's beautiful, and second, it will be important in certain applications. And third, it has a nice correspondent principle with quantum mechanics. So we saw that the Liouville equation, which was this way of writing the Hamiltonian equation with the Poisson bracket, has a nice analog in quantum mechanics with the Ehrenfest theorem. And this formulation of mechanics over here looks a lot like which famous equations in quantum mechanics?
Schrodinger.
The Schrodinger equation. So let's. So we have Schrodinger. So the Schrodinger equation reads like this. So let's see. Hopefully, I don't get too many wrong signs. So if we're working in the position representation, this will be just Q. This will be, well, let's write it in general, then I write it. So this is, it reads like this. In position representation, this is dt plus hq, and here we get d over dq, t psi. And in fact, well, it depends on the ordering we choose for these operators. So there are quantization ambiguity, but we will not talk about those here. So naively, that's what we get. So this is precisely that type of formula. Now, to get it more on the nose, what we do is to write psi as some real probability amplitude times a phase, like this, maybe with a plus. And if we now the recipe, plug this into there and develop in h bar and keep the leading order in h bar. Plug in the flower equation. And keep only leading order in h bar, which, by the way, it is order 0, so order 1. We get Hamilton-Jacobi with S replaced by phi. So this S, this action, this Hamilton's principal function is nothing else than the phase of the wave function. Right? Because this I and h bar will just simplify these two. So there is a term at which these, if I'm deriving rho, things will be order h bar. If I'm deriving the exponent, the h bar comes down, and it will eat these two. So this is the leading order term, the one where I derive the phase. So this is called the WKB approximation. And you might see it in quantum mechanics. It's not here really the place to go into that. But it's related to the is related to the semi-classical approximation of the path integral, for example, or of the Schrodinger equation, for that matter, WKB or semi-classical
approximation. What is
a
function of this?
Oh, this rho, so psi is a function of Q and T, and so are rho and Q. So these are and phi, sorry, rho and phi. Functions of Q and T. Yeah. I'm just doing, since psi is a complex number at every time and every position, I'm just decomposing it in a polar decomposition. So this will be the probability amplitude, right? And this is telling us about the interference of patterns. So I want to that's a recipe. So, or this has also, especially in the early days when people were more accustomed to optics rather than the Schrödinger equation, for them, they were seeing here lots of analogy with geometrical optics, the iconal approximation of geometrical optics, or ray, when you study instead of the propagation of waves in terms of waves, you think of them in terms of light rays. So how do you translate from one picture to the other? You go through a similar approximation. And they were, everybody knew about that. Today, nobody, very few people study optics, and more people study quantum mechanics. So we learn it backwards, but that was the way it was done. Okay, so this is everything concerning analytical mechanics. So we will come back to it towards the end after having done field theory. So we will, now we did this for the particle, we will apply the same idea, not all of them, but some of them, to the study of, in particular, the Noether theorem and the Euler-Lagrange equation, to the study of field theories towards the end of the course. But for now, we take a break and we move on to special relativity and field theories. So I think it's also a good time to just to take a bit of a pause and get questions on the first part of the course.
Yeah. I'm still having trouble understanding how that gives the equations of motion, because like the Q1 and T1 are boundary terms, right? So
yeah.
It tells you how your boundary moves, but how does it tell you about your history or like
that? Here I wrote it in terms of T1, but if you forget this label T1 and just think about T, for this equation, so we are asking how does this function changes if we change T1. But if we change only T1, we are essentially following the history. It's about the concerted change of T1 and Q1. So in a sense, it's about how to prolong this history to stay on shell. That's my intuition, at least, behind this formulation. So this is telling us how to continue drawing this line in this graph beyond the point I have arrived at. Now I ask, what happens if I change T1 and Q1 a little bit and want to stay on shell? Then I have to continue drawing in that, in a way that is compatible with that equation.
Is the T0 equation equivalent? Because I know there's
Yeah, because you can, in one case, you're going forward, in one case, backward. But the equations of motion look the same in the two directions of time, unless there is dissipation, but system with dissipation are not really Lagrangian systems, so we forget about that. Unless it has a very specific form, I'm not completely sure. But here, for a system without dissipation, a closed system, then it doesn't matter which way you. Yeah. Oh yeah, that's another. Okay. Yes. Thanks, Jackie. So, if you let's see. The best way to think about this, I haven't given you the tools to fully understand it. It's part of tutorial 2, I think. So we talked about canonical transformations, and we say that time evolution is a canonical transformation. In tutorial 2, we will see how to encode canonical transformations into what is called the generating function of the canonical transformation. Now, So this means that if I give you the right if I give you a certain function, you can deduce from it a canonical transformation. Now, but time evolution is a canonical transformation itself. So there must be a function that if I give it to you, you can deduce time evolution from it through a formula. And now this function is the function s. So, and the point here is that if you solve this equation, so you fix q0 and t0. So the procedure is like this. Fix q0 and t0 and find s of q1, t1, q0, t0 using Hamilton-Jacobi. Because this now is about the dependence on these two variables. So we focus on in q1, t1. Now, if then deduce p, you can deduce p1 at t1 by the formula ds over dq1, right? But this is, then you know everything about the dynamics, because here, whether you call it t1 or t, it doesn't really matter. So I can remove the label t and just say q and t. And I deduce p at time t by deriving these in q. So I know p at time t at every time, essentially. So this is all you need to know to compute the dynamics. So in fact, this is how one thinks about S being the generating function of time evolution in terms of this canonical transformation picture. It's a very different way of thinking about dynamics. It's counterintuitive. As far as this course is concerned, we are happy to have seen this equation and to know that it can be used to deduce dynamics. We will not do exercises where we actually do it. Is more of a conceptual tool for, as far as you are concerned, more than a computational tool. So I just wanted to present you this because it might come up in your projects or reading papers, and at least you, yeah.
So if I want to compute q of t, I'm gonna use the equation for like del s by del t. Like I have some like implicit equation for q of t.
No, it's like solving the Schrödinger equation, right? Like these two equations look exactly the same. So whichever way you like to think about solving your Schrödinger equation, you can apply it to solve this type of equation. So the Schrödinger equation starts from psi, a certain shape of psi at q0, t0. Here it's like choosing a one that is fully picked at a certain value at q0 given q0 and t0. And then you solve it. So it's like you start from a function at q0 and t0 and you evolve it to know what it is at q and t. And then you can deduce p by deriving it. It's just like, I think the maybe since you are more familiar with the Schrödinger equation than these formulations of mechanics, maybe it's more intuitive to go backwards. You can think of these as the semi-classical approximation of the Schrödinger equation. And you solve it in the same way, and the Schrödinger equation contains all the information about the mechanics of the system. And this one does too, just in the classical approximation of that equation. So maybe that's the more intuitive way to think about it.
So I get that we compute the function s, and then we compute p by differentiation. But how do we compute q? We compute it from like
no, but q is an argument. So, what this is doing is not, so here we are not solving this equation in terms of initial condition. So if you fix Q0 and V0, then you have just one Q1 at T1. This is a different way of thinking about mechanics in terms of boundary condition instead of initial conditions. So here, you're choosing Q0 and Q1 and determining which trajectory you're looking. So instead of, so is, you're, it's not completely, it's not that I need to find Q at time T. Depending on which Q I'm looking at a different solution. But at the same time, so this, as a formulation of mechanics, is equivalent, but it doesn't mean that it's formulated in the same way. So instead of fixing initial, is a formulation that doesn't really look at initial conditions, but at this boundary condition. So you're not thinking of time evolution as fixing something at the beginning and looking what comes out at the end. You're looking at these more complicated correlations. So you can compute the initial velocity, but if you solve for this function, the initial velocity is given by S derived by Q0. And this is your initial condition. So everything is repackaged in a, differently. And if you want, I don't know if you were presented this little mystery, but if one looks at the Schrödinger equation, one says, oh, this encodes dynamics completely, but it's a first order equation. But how is this possible if all my classical equations are second order? Well, this is how the trick is performed, by going to a quite different way of thinking about mechanics. Yes.
Could you interpret it as like, so if you plug in the Q1 and T1, then you could solve for a relationship between the T1 derivative and the Q1 derivative and basically find like a direction of ascent in the on-shell action. And then orthogonal to that would be like the steepest descent. And like that's how you would continue to minimize the on-shell action. So that's how the on-shell history would continue.
It sounds plausible. I don't. I would have to. Yeah, so these equations, these and the other one that we used to deduce Hamilton-Jacobi are deduced by doing what you're saying, which is we're essentially saying how does the velocity have to change given this change of Q and or T in order to stay on the on the minimum of this action function, essentially. So in this sense, it tells you how to stay at the bottom of this function moving forward in time.
It's kind of like a gradient descent.
Yeah, it's a, well, in the sense that it's a minimization process, or it's a stationary phase equation for that equation. So for example, let me give you a different example that maybe is a bit more intuitive. When you compute in optics, when you compute the path traveled by a light beam, what you can do is to say, I have my incident light beam. I know the diffraction indices N1 and N2. I can use Snell's law to compute the ratio of these angles. And I will tell you where it's going afterwards. Or I can use Fermat's principle and say, instead of deduce theta 2 as a function of theta N1 and N2 using Snell's law, I can say, let me fix the two points. Theta 2 as a function of theta given theta 1 given the Snell law. Or I can fix the endpoint and compute the path of all path that minimizes the travel time between these two points, knowing that the speed of light depends on n. So this is another variational problem, which in fact inspired these action principles, and encodes the same. But instead of mechanically asking, oh, what happens at this point with the change of refraction index, how is the light deviated, I'm rather thinking more globally in terms of where the light is starting from and where it has to go. And then there is a principle that tells me which path is selected. And this is essentially what this equation is doing. But instead of globally, it's doing it piece by piece. But it's still fixing the boundary condition rather than telling me the step-by-step evolution of what happens next given the direction. So here, you see, there is a starting point and a direction of travel as conditions. Here, I don't know which direction this will start traveling. I deduce it based on where I want it to arrive. And this Hamilton-Jacobi is similar in the sense that you have q0, t0, and q1, t1. You don't know the initial velocity. You will figure out the initial velocity once you know how to pick the right solution that arrives where you want it to arrive at the time you want it to arrive. So it's a backwards way of thinking about dynamics, which is the one in line with the variational principle. But we're really not used to think about it in these terms. So if we want, Snell's law is like the Euler-Lagrange equation, and the Fermat principle is like the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, or the action principle. This one is an infinitesimal version of the action principle. That's another way I think of putting it. It's about how the action changes if I change the on-shell action changes given. But yeah, don't worry too much about Hamilton-Jacobi. What we did in the previous lectures is more important. I would say, if there are questions about the other lectures, let's go to those, and I'm happy to discuss Hamilton-Jacobi separately. It will not be part of tutorials, homeworks, or the interview. So, if you're super excited about it, it's great. So we can chat, but it's not priority. That's what I'm trying to say. So should I do some special relativity? I will be a bit more relaxing, I assume. Okay. So. So I don't know if it is, if I'm misremembering, it is apocryphal or something, but once I think I read a quote of this sort, Mr. Hamilton saying, Mr. Lagrange asked, posed the problem of the then, I don't know, asked the problem of dynamics in terms of a variational principle and so on. And he said, Mr. Hamilton solved it. So he was very modest, it seems. And what he was referring to was this Hamilton-Jacobi equation, I think. So in a way, was the for them at the time, this equation was the highest possible formulation of mechanics. Yes. I might be completely misremembering what this quote that I read, who knows when. But OK, so. Principle of relativity. In the lecture notes, I have reported three quotes, one from Poincaré, one from Einstein, and one from Galileo back in the 1600s. And if you've never read Galileo, I really encourage you to do it. It's quite nice. And it really gives the idea of, in a very poetic and pictorial term, of the idea of the principle of relativity. So here I will just do a mixed match of Poincaré and Einstein. And so what is this principle of relativity? It says that the law of physics must be the same for a stationary observer as for an observer, as for an observer carried along in a uniform motion of translation. And importantly, the implication is that we do not have any means of discerning whether we are moving or not. So, but the so here there are a few remarks that I will make, and then I will ignore just after having made them. So, this first of all is the special principle of relativity, not the general principle. The general principle tries to get rid of this restriction of uniform motion with respect to each other. It wants to have laws of physics that can be written in any possible reference frame, irrespective of how they are moving with respect to each other. But the special principle has this restriction. And this restriction is slightly problematic because how do you pick the first stationary reference frame, right? So there is a well-known philosophical problem of how to actually define these. In fact, these are called inertial reference systems. How do you define them in absolute terms? Once you have one, you know how to find the others. But how do you find the first one in the first place? So it's usually a circular problem. And therefore, in a way, the formulation of general relativity, which is based on the general principle of relativity, is a huge step forward in the direction of solving this conceptual issue. But here we will forget about it. We know how it's the same problem that one has in Newtonian mechanics, and we live with it. So we will keep living with this issue for now. Quite quite remarkably, one can start from a mathematical formulation of this idea together with the principle, extra hypotheses, which usually are implicit in this context, which are isotropy and homogeneity. So in a way, to have things that do not change under uniform motion of translation, it means that space must be homogeneous. This cannot change from one point to the next. So this is kind of implicit in a way. And isotropy adds the idea that also if we rotate things around, things shouldn't change. But in one spatial dimension, which is where we will start from, homogeneity is the only relevant condition. This is just telling me that the x-axis and the z-axis are not different. But starting from the relativity principle, with these hypotheses, one can deduce that so these things imply that all inertial frames are related by either a Galilean or a Lorentz transformation. So we will write them in a second, what these are, but Lorentz transformation, you know what they are, and Galilean are just the limit for C to infinity of these laws. So essentially, it's telling us that the relativity principle implies, it tells us that there are two types of kinematics compatible with it, the one from Newtonian mechanics and the one from special relativity. There's nothing else. And the one from Newtonian mechanics over here is just a limit of the other one. So in a way, this is easy a posteriori, of course, but in a way one could have discovered Lorentz transformation and the existence of a universal speed even before knowing about Maxwell equations. Just following this principle to its extreme conclusions. It's very hard to do a priori, and it wasn't done, but as a hypothetical, in an hypothetical world, this could have been possible. So there is a reference that works out this deduction in the lecture notes if you want to have a look. I will not try to reproduce it here, but there are various derivations of this kind, and the one that I found the one that seemed nice. Okay, so what is a Lorentz transformation? So let's work in one spatial dimension for now, and so if K described by x and t and K prime described by x prime and t prime are inertial frames, with two things. One, x equals 0, t equals 0 coincides with x prime equals 0, t prime equals 0, so they have a common origin. And two, k prime is moving at velocity v with respect to k. Then we find that x prime should be related to x and t in this way, and t prime should be related to T. What am I doing? Okay. Where gamma, of course, is the Lorentz factor. So this is this is of course a Lorentz transform. In the limit c to infinity, what we find is that x prime is x minus vt, t prime is equal to t, and this is a Galilean. In fact, let me call it with its better name. This is not a general Lorentz transformation, it's a Lorentz boost. And this is a Galilean boost. We will see that what we want to call Lorentz transformations are more general, they include rotations. And yeah, that's it. But in one dimension, that's all there is. So this is easy to understand, right? It's just how we change from in the coordinate system on a moving train compared to the train station. In one case, the coordinate x being at constant x prime means moving at velocity v in the other frame. And in special relativity, the relationships are more complex. This one is just deformed by this factor, but the more important one is that time is not absolute anymore. It depends on the frame we're in. Let me mention, just to spice things up a little bit, that there is another interesting limit of these equations. So I put it up here, which is the limit c goes to 0. And now, for this, for these equations to make sense, of course, we need v squared to be less than c squared. Otherwise, this would be imaginary, and this would make no sense. So this already tells us that velocities larger than c are not allowed as changes of frames. So if we send here c to 0, why we are not usually not so interested in this is because at the same time, we need to send v to 0. So this means that v also has to go to 0. And this seems to trivialize everything, right? We say x equal to x prime equal to x, t prime equal to t, so what the hell is going on? But the trick, of course, is to say, no, I don't want this to go to 0 randomly. I want this to stay constant, in fact. So this is not just going to 0. We have that c v squared v has to go to 0 at the same speed as c squared, so that this tends to some constant b. And then these transformations become, it's easy to see, they flip the role of t and x compared to the Galilean boosts. And this is called a Carolian. I don't know if to call it boost because it's, but let's say Carolian transformation. So you see, in a world described by Galilean boost, time is absolute. In a world described by Carolian transformations, space is absolute. In fact, because of this, v has to go to 0. This means that nothing can move. So it's a very weird world. And it's called after Carol, of the author of Alice in Wonderland, exactly because there is somewhere a little story where Alice is running and going nowhere. So here, no matter how fast you run, how close to the speed of light you run, you don't go anywhere because x prime is always x. So that's the origin of the name. And no matter how weird this looks, it does have some applications in physics when studying null hypersurfaces in GR. So null hypersurfaces are very peculiar places to be. And since you can't go faster than the speed of light, if you are on an unhyper surface, you stay where you are, essentially. So that's the rough idea. And the relevant geometry for those is described by this one. So when studying black hole horizons, or maybe asymptotic infinity, and so on, these structures will appear. And they're quite fashionable these days. So I just wanted to put it out there. It was proposed in the 70s as a curiosity, but 40 years later, it became very much used. OK. So this is now what we want to do is to understand a little better what this thing is. To me, it always looked like it's a very mysterious formula. It doesn't look like much. So of course, there is a change of variables that makes it look much more intuitive. So since the idea is that since V over C is a number between minus 1 and 1, there is usually a nice, smooth change of variables that that is available then, which is the following. We define the rapidity as the arc hyperbolic tangent of V over C. So the hyperbolic tangent of psi is e to the psi minus e to the minus psi divided by the same thing with a plus. And it's a nice function that looks like this. So this is V over C, and this is psi. So the magic is that under this change, and let me define also the hyperbolic sine and the hyperbolic cosine. They are basically a real version of the trigonometric functions, where instead, for the cos, there is an I there, and for the sine, there is I there and down here. They're analytic continuations of those. So now we have, if you do this change of variable, it's a matter of turning the machine to see that the main thing is that this is always positive, and that this is there is a minus sign in this. So with this change of variable, what we get is that this is cosh psi. Well, let me write it in a matrix form now. It looks nicer. This is cosh psi, sinh psi. Well, am I using I need minus signs. So this I want to call lambda psi for now. And of course, what I have in mind when I write these formulas is rotations, right? So this is So this looks very much like a 2D rotation all of a sudden, with some signs flipped, but in special relativity, one puts we will always draw the space-time axis reversed. Evolution goes upwards, not left, rightwards. Now, let's
let's look at what these
how these transformations look like. So if I take my axes x and y and I rotate them, what happens is that the new axis will look like this. Oops. Well, doesn't matter. Y. So that a point on the axis here is dragged along a circle. So what happens if I draw the same diagram based on this type of transformation instead? The point will be dragged along a hyperbola. So the point here, well, let me. So first of all, the two axes get, they don't turn, they squeeze. And a point here will be there are these special lines, as we will see in a moment, which are, so I should write to be completely correct. I will always forget to add factors of C, but these are C, T, and CT prime. Otherwise, they would not be able to sit on the same diagram in a way, in a symmetric fashion. So we want them to be spatial, like length unit, both of them. So here we have that this is dragged along an hyperbola, like this. And this point over here is dragged along an hyperbola, like that. And in which direction? This goes like this, and this one go like that. And similarly over here. Up. And this one will go in this direction, and this one will go in this direction. So this is a Euclidean geometry, if you want. Euclidean plane, and this is an hyperbolic plane. So what do we learn by looking at these figures? Well, one important thing is that the first observation is that here, this length maybe I should keep it for last. Let's first do something slightly easier. So the observation is that, let's see. First and foremost, the notion of simultaneity is observer dependent. So one, simultaneity is observer dependent. So in the frame K, so what does it mean? It means that what happens at t equals 0 has different meaning in different frames. So t equals 0 is not equivalent to t prime equals 0, right? So one is the white axis, the other is the red axis. So what happens at the same time in the frame K will happen at different times in the frame K prime, or vice versa. Two, so this is usually the solution to all paradoxes in special relativity. Yes?
Delta t equals 0 because we select the frames to coincide both in the space and the temporal axis.
Oh, what I mean is that t equals 0 in here is an axis, is the x-axis. So it's your notion of space. What is So this is the set of points. So the set of point x, t equals 0, is not the set of point x prime, t equals 0. So I should put them as sets.
T prime.
Right? So this is the x-axis. X-axis. This is the x prime axis. So what the observer at the train station would say, so there is a series of events that happen at time t equals 0, at the instant t equals 0 in the frame of the observer, of the person on the at the train station. From the point of view of the person on the train, all these events that are happening at once from the perspective of the person at the train station will happen at different times from the perspective of the observer on the train. So that's what this is saying. And two, we remember that v must be smaller than c. So what does it mean? It means that everything that is moving in these diagrams over here, we'll have to have a slope, steeper, in fact, than 45 degrees. So it means that whatever is arriving here, so whatever object, physical object, a person at x0, t0 is receiving, will have to become from within this region. Now I've erased everything underneath, but so this means, and vice versa, it will, whatever he sends out in the world will stay within this other region here. So this says that the present doesn't exist, if you want, but this other observation tells us that we have a very strong notion of what is the future and the past of an event. And so they look like this. So this is CT, X. And this is, so this is the future. And this is the past. And together they're called the causal domain. And causal means as really, you have to think about it in terms of what these things can receive and send out in the world. So they can be influenced only by things happening in their past light cone or in the future light cone. I hope you are familiar with this language. So this is the future light cone, the past light cone, and the light cone itself is the yellow dotted lines. So here, the notion of, future, past. And these are refined and absolute. So they do not depend on which frame I'm choosing. This description will not change depending on which frame I'm choosing. As long as I say with respect to what I'm talking about, future and past, is not t positive and t negative. Is with respect to an event. So I fix an event, and then I can talk about the future of O and the past of O. And these notions are absolute, are frame independent. So whereas the present is not, the future, the causal future and the causal past are absolute, but they're not just what lies above and below this axis, is what lies within and with within this cone. So I think I will stop I will stop here, and next time we will keep going from